Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August the 31st, 1999, and in Koine in the Fireside Room this morning is Ruth Doherty's session, The Holy Roman Empire, The Supreme Oxymoron. It's her second session for 1999. Let's listen in.
So many people ask me, when is the Middle Ages? And the Middle Ages really are a gamut. You know, most of the people, nobody that lived in the Middle Ages were talking about we're in the Middle Ages. They weren't named the Middle Ages until 1800s. So, and that was when it was between the times, between the modern times and the ancient times. So it was the Middle Times, the Middle Ages. The people who were living in the Middle Ages thought they were in the modern times, and they called it the modern times. So we go back and say Middle Ages, and then we realize, if we look back at it, when you really know something about the Middle Ages, you realize that the times were not what we often call now Middle Ages. That's medieval. Because medieval seems to be sort of benighted. And the term the Dark Ages is also a poor term, because there were things happening and things growing and things developing during what is labeled the Dark Ages. The reason they're really Dark Ages is because this is a time there's not a lot written and we don't know very much about it. And so we are in the dark about what was going on during that time. But that doesn't mean that the people were in the dark. They were still carrying on the old Roman world. The people in what we now know as Western Europe, main part of Europe, were still continuing on with what had been going on in the old classical Roman world. The roads were still there, the aqueducts were still there, some of the armies were still there in a lot of places, and gradually that diminished. And I'm not going to take time to really say why Rome actually fell, but there were a lot of reasons for it. But in some ways, the culture continued and gradually faded. Gradually, so that people no longer knew how to build the way they had built and had to relearn. One good example is the cathedral in Florence, which was not built until the 1300s, into the 14th century. And here you have, they did not know how to build a cupola. They had to go back and rediscover how to build things like that. Because it had been there during Roman times, but it was no longer. When is the end of it? When is the beginning? Most of the time people say the beginning of it is when actually Roman fell completely. In 410 it was vandalized, and then in 476 it was taken over by the Visigoths, the Western Goths, and essentially Roman rule ended. There was no longer any ruler in Rome. The only ruler was in Byzantium, in Constantinople, the city that Constantine founded. Consequently, who is going to be the dominant person in Rome? It's the Pope, it's the bishop, the Papa. And that's an Italian term, Papa, the father. Gradually, then, that Pope became stronger, and they'll pick up that story. He does not claim the keys of the king's keys of St. Peter until in the 8th century. So that story in Matthew does not get used until the 8th century.
Does that tie in with Charlemagne?
9th century, actually. In the time of Charlemagne's grandson, Lothar. So, in the end, I really feel by 1300, a lot of the Middle Ages had finished. The 12th century, the 1100s, was a marvelous period of tremendous growth. The 13th century, the 1200s, is a tremendous period of just flowering, of developing that, of scholasticism. By the 14th century, the 1300s, you had a decline of the things that had been developed during the Middle Ages. And you had, instead of the age of faith, you had this determining how important man is. And when you see Leonardo da Vinci's with his measure of man, you realize that this is the direction they're going in. Now the period in which people have really developed their faith and realized, which is what happens in the 12th century, they discover God's grace. And then you have tremendous development of architecture. It's not till then, that is all sort of lost again. And then man begins to search for himself and discover himself and say, well, I don't have to depend on God, I can depend on myself. And it's lost. So I'm going to pick up today from about 500, which is about the time of the end of the Roman Empire, and deal with what happened in the Holy, what they call the Holy Roman Empire. And I'm going to pick up a few stories. Some of them will fill up the gaps of what we talked about yesterday, those who were there. Fill up some gaps just accidentally, and then create some new ones. So if you don't mind, since you're close to the lights, we'll turn those off, and you can turn the other one off too, the one that goes up, the end one goes up. Yeah. Oh no, well, there's a reverse. Well, don't worry about it. Thank you, Evelyn. Well, Pope Gregory I, and we know him from the Gregorian chants, was essentially the first pope that said, I'm going to claim some authority here. And one of the things that he did, besides saying we've got to unify the church and the way liturgy is worshipped, he also picked up something that Benedict of Nursia had developed, and that was a monastic, a set of rules that said this is the way monasteries should be run. Before that, monks had lived individually, or if they lived collectively, they had no rules, nothing specific. Benedict of Nursia, who says about 476 creates these rules, says there should be certain times for prayer, certain times for work, there should be certain times for fasting, etc., etc. So Gregory picks up Benedict's rules and said all monks, and there'll be a time that we'll be talking about monasteries, all monks should follow, all monasteries, nuns and monks, should follow the same rules. So this is one of the things that Gregory does. But he establishes a strong papal presence in Rome. Another thing that he does is that he sends a missionary, Augustine, up to Britain. Now, Britain was Christian. You realize that when the Roman soldiers had come up, they brought up Christianity. And so so there was Christianity there. We know of St. Patrick, who was a Welshman, who then went into Ireland as a slave, and then came back, learned more about Christianity, went back into Ireland, and Christianized Ireland. So Christianity was there in Britain, but it was a slightly different form of Christianity. And it wasn't as strong. So Benedict sends Augustine, and he comes into Canterbury and develops. And if you go to Canterbury, there is a St. Augustinian monastery, ruins of it there. that you will see. You will also see St. Martin's Church, which you have to kind of look for. It's an old Anglo-Saxon church. If you go inside, you see the old Anglo-Saxon building inside. You see where the queen came in on a side door, and how where she came in to worship. These are my granddaughters, who are now 18 and 20. But if you ever get to Canterbury, look for St. Martin's Church. You have to go off the beaten path in order to find it, but it's a wonderful discovery. And you realize that from here then, you had Britain, the English part of it, Christianized in a different way. This is the cross of Dumfriesshire, and this is a cross which is very much like the Irish would have used, but it is decorated in a Roman way, which says that after the Treaty of Whitby, which was one that the Irish and the English agreed on, is that the Irish agreed to follow the Roman liturgy. Before that, they had their own liturgy, their own seasons of the year. They had a different Easter, and it was a great controversy. This is one of the things that that came as a result of Gregory's strength. So I love that story in Britain, how the Irish and the British contended early on over what time was Easter. Well, I'm going to bring you now to about 800, and this map is actually a little later. But by 800, that's 300 years later, I'm going to have to change the map just a little bit. This is the Byzantine Empire, and they are also over here. Essentially, the Byzantines are ruling everything. They say they rule the whole West. They say they rule the whole West. But there is no way that they're here in Constantinople can they really be in control of here. Stephen, who is in Rome, says, I need help. The Lombards are coming down and are coming into this area. Now, Lombardy in northern Italy, Milan, Pavia, Parma, that area. Well, they were going to come down here and threaten Rome. He said, I need help. He calls over here to the ruler in Constantinople. This guy's threatened by all sorts of things. He said, I can't help. So he turns up to Pepin, who is the mayor of the Merovingian kings. He's not the king. He's the mayor, but he's the guy that's got power. His father had at Poitiers pushed back the Muslims that had been coming up here into Britain. This is the son, Pepin is the son of Charles Martel. So Pepin says, Pope in Rome, Stephen, comes up to Pepin and says, hey, can you give me some help? And Pepin says, I'll make a deal with you. You make me king, I'll help you. The Pope says, okay, you prove it to me. So Pepin gathers an army, comes down, pushes the Lombards out, and keeps his promise, and so the Pope also keeps his, and he anoints him as king of the Franks. His son is
Charlemagne.
So Charlemagne then picks up this whole territory. When you say Carolingian, this is Carolingian Empire. So by 800, Charlemagne has actually pushed back. He didn't always succeed here at the Pass of Roncesvalles. You hear that story, how he was defeated here. But most of the time he succeeded. He also tried to get these two empires together. Supposedly he traveled to Constantinople trying to put these empires together, but he wanted to be the ruler, of course. It didn't quite work. If we take a look at Charlemagne here on this horse, what would you see about Charlemagne? What would you notice on him?
He's not very big.
What's not very big?
Well, he is not physically.
He looks Asian.
Yeah, that's what I saw.
He looks, I see what you mean.
He looks Asian to me, too.
Mm-hmm. He looks Asian?
Yeah, a little bit of an Asian.
It's not a possibility.
Maybe it's a beard, just the way he's depicted, okay. But that takes me also.
Take a look at that horse. How big is the horse?
Pretty small.
He's pretty small. Charlemagne was 6'5" tall.
He was. Sat in his chair and it didn't seem too big.
Well, you're not short. You're not a little old guy either. But take a look at that. Just take a look at that, you know, him in relationship to the horse. I mean, that horse, the horses were small at that time. But you put any guy on a horse and it would not look like that. Now, I'm not saying that this was a real attempt to be actual, but he was a huge guy. Can you imagine at the time that not very many people were much over 5 feet tall?
That's true.
In those days, it's
true. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now look at his feet.
Not very big.
What's missing?
Doesn't
look like real stirrups.
Stirrups. Stirrups are missing. Can you imagine riding on that horse without stirrups? See. At this point, they had not picked up the stirrups yet. The Mongols had stirrups, but they had not been brought in yet. It wasn't until into the 9th century, in the 800s, that the Franks begin to pick up stirrups. And then, because of that, they are able to defeat their enemies. So then, of course, once somebody gets them, then everybody gets them. But stirrups are very important in terms of riding a horse. It certainly was later on when they were coming with these great big lances. Can you imagine? You couldn't have used a lance without stirrups. Well, the Pope finds that Charlemagne is also doing what he wants him to do. He has defended Rome for him, and therefore, in 800, when Charlemagne was in Rome at Christmas time, he is crowned. Now, one of the things that historians ask is, did Charlemagne really want to be crowned? Did he ask to be crowned? Did the Pope do this in order to say, I'm superior to you, I have power over you by crowning you? So it's a great question, but in any case, the Pope definitely claimed to have authority over him by crowning him.
Do you recall which king was it that took the crown out of the Pope's hand and put it on his own head?
Frederick II.
Is that him? Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He was a guy that I really respect. Actually, and here's Charlemagne. This is a 12th century statue, all in gold, but it actually has on it the crown, the type of crown that the Holy Roman Empress then got when Otto I was crowned. But he was really somebody special. Not only was he 6'5", but he considered himself also a priest, and then lived as a priest of the church. In other words, he felt himself a protector of the church, a builder of the church, in a way that kings later on, when they spoke of the kings as being given the authority by God. Charlemagne says, yeah, God has given me authority and given me a responsibility, which is quite different. And this is his amulet. And you notice what's in the center of that?
Mm-hmm.
A cross. What kind of a cross?
Roman cross.
Roman cross. It's very likely, nobody's taken this apart, they can't prove it, but it's very likely a piece of the true cross, which Helen, Constantine's mother, supposedly legendarily, had found. So this true cross was a very important thing that he wore. I'm sure he believed it was a piece of the true cross. So he was very connected with the church. And one of the things that he also did, since he had this great vast territory now that he's ruling, is that he managed to figure out a way that he, a single man, now he could rule this whole territory. So one of the things that he developed was the county system. He, under every 100 people, now he would have only counted men, you realize, men that were significant, that were not slaves, every 100 person would have some person over him. And that is the way he could control this whole territory. He broke it up in counties in that way. Essentially, he begins the feudal system in which you have one person who is responsible for a variety of other people, and then those people are responsible to him. Essentially, this is a way he could establish an army. Those who are in charge would be responsible for bringing up so many men, so many soldiers, so much armor, so many arms. And then he built this church, which in Aachen or Aix-la-Chapelle, depend upon whether it's French or German at the particular time. And this is an area that has switched territories. Right now it's in Germany, in Aachen. Again, from yesterday, I said the church in Ravenna was built how? By Justinian, do you remember? It was both a square and a circle, octagonal. The square to say that it is of the earth, and the circle of God. So you have this combination of church. And where is this where his throne is up here?
It was up on the second
level.
Yes.
Right there.
I'll show you when I go there.
I'll have to be there too.
Your brother took us there, so we don't know where we're
going. Yeah, and see, the church is right now that the church in Aachen has been baroqueized and gothicized, but the basic church is still within it. Mm-hmm. He was very interested in learning, developed. Up to this time, the monasteries had been the only place where there had been learning, and so he wanted to develop learning, so he started schools in the cathedrals. And now he's looking for teachers. Now where is he going to go for a teacher? Where do you suppose?
To monasteries.
To monasteries, you? Yes, where? Is he going to go to Rome? Rome fizzled. Rome just no longer has the learning. What's been going on in Rome has only been politics. He goes up to York in England to Alcuin, because in Britain, what we know now as Britain, have been these monasteries that have developed these wonderful learning. This is a Lindisfarne gospel. This is from the Gospel of Chad, that they have these wonderful decorations. This is also the Lindisfarne. So he goes up. These have all been developed in the 700s. Tremendous artistic and intellectual developing in Britain in the 700s. So he goes up, brings Alcuin down, develops universities in the cathedrals, and then has his own scriptorium. This is from his own Bible, the Bible that was developed for him. And he was able to read, but he never learned to write, at least not successfully. This is from his own, the school of Charlemagne, Palace of Charlemagne. This is
the Gospel of Mark, from the Gospel of Mark. And you notice it's very Byzantine. Later, this is from the Gospel of Matthew in the Bible of Ebo. And you notice the difference? What do you see is different?
Left-handed.
I may. They both seem to be, don't they?
Yeah.
Clothes are different.
Clothes are different. Do you notice the vitality here?
This one seems to be very tired and bothered.
This one's, but there's motion. There's a lot of motion. There's nothing. His face says, I've got work to do. I've really at it. There's a story behind it. The same vitality that seemed to go into the Carolingian Renaissance is what they called it. This is from the Utrecht Psalter. And it has two things. Of course, here you have the same kind of drawing as in the Gospel of Ebo. But you have the stories are all here. Here someone is given the blessing from the church, and then he goes off and fights. And so you have actually here a picture of the battles between two different peoples. Also, you have the Carolingian script, which essentially we're still using when we read. Before that, it was very difficult to have read what people had been writing. So the Carolingian script is something very important that Charlemagne began. Well, his son, Louis the Pious, took over, but he was maybe a little bit too pious. You know, he was a goody-goody. And one of the problems that Louis the Pious left for the empire, which the Holy Empire, was that he had too many sons. One of his sons was Lothar. Another one was Charles the Bald, and Louis the German. At least that's the names they're giving. Initially, Lothar was supposed to get this territory, but be the main ruler. See, that would have included Aachen, Aix-la-Chapelle. And Charles the Bald would get this, and Louis the German would get this. Well, you can imagine what happens. What's going to happen? Who's got the power?
Paris. Reims.
Well, the two big ones.
The two big ones, yeah. So it's going to be a squeeze play.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Are we still fighting over this territory?
Yeah.
See?
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm.
Huh. Alsace-Lorraine is there,
uh-huh.
And so it's something that France and Germany have been fighting over for a long time. If you look at, Rand McNally was here in the 9th century, you can see he would have had a great time making maps, constantly changing. Supposedly this is the Holy Roman Empire. 7 years later, in 1843, the guys made a treaty and they said, yeah, we'll accept this. It didn't take long. By 844, they had already changed. So this supposedly is the Holy Roman Empire in 850. Lothar's already squeezed out. This is supposedly this in 870. See, this is actually would be the Holy Roman Empire now. And that keeps changing. 880. This is Burgundy. You still have an exarchate from Byzantium over here. It's hard to keep track of what's going on. There are constant frustration, constant wars. There's constant warring between brothers. Ultimately, it's the guy who is a Saxon who takes over. Now, at the same time that all this is going on, you've got someone coming down from Norway, from Scandinavia. It's these Vikings. And they are terrorizing French. Specifically, in here, they come down the rivers here and just terrorize this territory. These guys are a little stronger and can push them off, but down here, they are just messing them up. So that weakens the French even more. So that ultimately it's the Germans who take over it, the Saxons. And this is, my dad is also named Otto, so I love this guy. This is Otto the First, who is then in 963 crowned Holy Roman Empire Emperor. And he is able to get all these little duchies and dukes and everything together and working together in what we now think of as Germany, and does a pretty good job of it. But ultimately, he's going to have, well, let's deal with this first. Here's Ottmarsheim, one of the buildings that was built under that, in the 11th century. But take a look at this. Have you seen that before?
Yeah.
Charlemagne.
Yeah.
You're just missing the throne here, aren't you? This is in Germany, and this is Essen Cathedral. Isn't that amazing? But if you go back and remember what San Vitale looked like in Ravenna, it's not a lot different. This is saying we're imitating the kings. These are places of the king's residences. So the Ottonians are able to take over this whole area, and this essentially becomes a Holy Roman Emperor. And but one of the things, how are they going to deal? How are they going to control this territory? They're not intellectual people themselves, so they need intellects to work for them. Where are they going to find it?
In the monasteries.
In the monasteries.
Okay.
Wherever you've got people who are learned. So they go to the monasteries and they choose people that know something. They go to the church where they are, or to the cathedrals where they are learned, and they choose their bishops and make them important people in their territory. They make them essentially the rulers of the church. They choose them, and with you are chosen, you got to make a deal. Okay, I'm going to choose you for a bishop, and then you're going to fight for me, right? Yeah. Either that or you're not chosen as bishop. And being bishop is going to give you a lot of power and riches.
So it became political. Yeah.
It became political. So then these Ottonians are really controlling their territory through their bishops. And the bishops are not just churchmen, they are also fighting men. So they carry two roles. They have a role in governing the church. They were not always very religious, but they governed the church, and they also fought. So is that going to create a problem? You bet. So at the time of Henry IV, he is trying to control this whole mess. And he's going to say, I will put the people I want here and a person I want here. And these guys are always fighting against each other. They're fighting him. This is when you have nothing that's really secure in the Middle Ages. One of the things that the only way that you can have dominion is by gaining it by war. So they're constantly fighting. So you want to get somebody on your side. We're still doing that. It hasn't changed. Only we do it sort of with a certain amount of diplomacy now. Well, they thought they were doing it too. I think they probably were. So what you had here is this great big melee of different provinces, duchies, bishoprics, etc. And Henry IV gets himself into trouble.
this is now in the 11th century, about 1050. He is trying to buy, he buys these, or what he does is, there's, it was called simony later on, where if you want a job, you pay for it. Only this is sort of in reverse. He puts these people into his positions that he wants. Well, do you think the Pope is going to like this? It's the ruler who is putting in his bishops. So Pope Gregory VII says, this has got to change. Gregory VII says, I am going to clean up the church. It's just, it's going to be the church that's in control, not the king any longer. So he says, I am going to clean up. And what he does is excommunicate Henry IV. Now what's so significant about excommunication? So you can't go to the go to communion. What's so big about that? What else can't you do?
Well, he
can't install the bishops anymore.
The clergy? The connection between the bishops from the disciples. Is broken, and that was
It wouldn't have to be broken. No, you could still have a laying on of hands.
But
so
you
would
have
still
to be
continuity.
Laid upon by a bishop who has had previous, has been made bishop.
So he could not make any other bishops. Okay. What else could he not do? What else? You realize that when the king is excommunicated, everybody's excommunicated.
So he doesn't have the following of the people.
He does not have the following of the people any longer, because there can be no more baptisms, there can be no more burials, there can be no more weddings, there can be no more anointing in oil, no more communication, no more penances, the churches are closed. It is essentially, and you know, realize this is the time that we're going to talk about the age of faith. This is a time where people are scared. And if they cannot have the rights of the church, what's going to happen to them? There is no choice but to go to hell. So you're right, Karin. They're not going to, he's not going to have the support of the people. So a lot of these people turn against him. And he says, okay, I give in. So the Pope Gregory VII and Henry IV are going to get together someplace in Germany. But Henry IV realizes that he's not going to win under those terms. So what he does is go down to the Alps and meets the Pope at Carnassa in 1077 at the home of Matilda of Tuscany. And here this particular thing is where the abbot of Cluny and Matilda are encouraging him to plea to the Pope for forgiveness and to have the excommunication lifted. So Henry IV actually allows that to happen, and the story is that he stands barefoot out in the snow for 3 days asking forgiveness from Gregory VII. Ultimately, Gregory VII gives in, the excommunication is lifted, Henry IV goes back and tries to continue to do what he's been doing all along. But nevertheless, in the process, the Pope has gotten another peg up. Now he's just that much more important than he was before, because Henry IV had abdicated himself to the Pope.
Was that was at Cluny?
This is, I'm trying to think of his name, the Abbot of Cluny.
Abbot of Cluny.
Yeah, this is at Carnassa, C-A-N-O-S-S-A. Carnassa. C-A-R-N-O-S-S-A. Well, the next person I want to pick up is someone you mentioned before, and that is Frederick II, who was the grandson of Roger II of Sicily. He is also the grandson of Frederick Barbarossa, who was then one of the Holy Roman Emperors. Well, Frederick was probably the most outstanding ruler intellectually that Europe has ever known. It's called him the Stupor Mundi, the wonder of the world, because he was such a brain, so capable of doing so many things, but he ended up getting excommunicated pretty seriously. His problem here, he was here in Sicily, but he was also ruler of Germany. And in Sicily, he had worked very well combining both the Norman culture and the Arabic culture that's there. And if you go into the Mortarana here, which is over here, it is just full of marvelous mosaics. So one of the things that happens in Sicily, that we have combined these three cultures, you've combined the Greek, you've combined the Arabic, and you've combined the Norman. And it is a marvelous place. The architecture just blows me away. But here's this guy that fits into this multicultural thing, but he threatens Rome. He's not going to do what the Pope says he wants him to do. So the Pope says, I'm going to excommunicate you. Frederick says, no, wait a minute. Don't excommunicate me. I will go on the Crusades. I will go back and win Jerusalem for you. The Pope says, okay, we'll see if you can do that. So Frederick is trying to do this. He's also sort of, the Pope is about to excommunicate him for something else, but he gives in. And Frederick is about to go on Crusades, and the bubonic plague threatens. Now the bubonic plague has come into the Mediterranean, but has not been carried up further north yet. This is in the 1200s. Am I right? Yes. And so the boats are already aboard on their way to the Holy Land. The bubonic plague breaks out on the boats, and they say, you can't go, we're not going to do any good. So they turn around and come back. He postpones the crusade, and he's excommunicated. Frederick is excommunicated. Well, you know, I think he was just at this Pope, I can't stand this guy. Well, a few years later, after he's gotten things together, he goes on crusades again. Does he fight? Instead, he talks to the Saladin, convinces him to give him Jerusalem freely. So Saladin returns Jerusalem to Frederick II. Frederick II claims himself king of Jerusalem, and the Pope excommunicates him. He was supposed to go and fight. He was supposed to go kill those heretics. Mm-hmm. So he didn't do it right. But nevertheless, in that time, he had been crowned by the king, by the Pope, I mean, as Holy Roman Emperor. So he was one of the Holy Roman Emperors. Well, the last story I'm going to tell is about Avignon, where ended up being dominated by the French king. The French king, the only place where it's safe, because the Italians are going to kill the Pope that is now French, so he moves into Italian territory at this time, but closer to a place where the French king can protect him. This is in 1305, 1309, and he is, then this is called the Babylonian Captivity of the Papacy, where the French are containing the Pope at this time in France. The French Pope does not have much power over anything going on in Italy, and it ends up with actually three popes at the same time, because the Electoral College of the Red Hats,
Cardinals,
thank you, are electing different popes to get back. There was a time the Pope went back to Italy, and then he was scared and he came back to Avignon. So from this time on, essentially, there is no, the popes no longer have political clout. The Holy Roman Empire continues nominally only. It just sort of, someone says, I'm Holy Roman Emperor, and someone else says, yeah, but doesn't mean anything else. And so it's not unlikely that Voltaire in the 1800s would have said, the Holy Roman Empire is neither holy nor Roman nor in heaven.
Where is this?
This is in Avignon.
Oh.
You know, on the bridge in Avignon. We are dancing. Okay, things you want to add, questions you want to ask.
First, a comment. I think that it was a very stimulating introduction. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Now we have to study.
Well, we've got 15 minutes to talk. I kind of rushed through this in order to, so that we wouldn't just end up, that I wouldn't just end up talking at you.
How many popes do we really talk about during the periods that you talk about?
When many, because some of them lived 2 years and some of them lived 5 years. Gregory the First lived an extended length of time, Gregory the Seventh again. Nicholas the First, who was at the time of Lothar, was the first one who actually then says, picks up that Matthew passage and says, I, the Pope, claim the key to be Pope on the basis of this Matthew passage that God gives to Peter, the keys of the kingdom. So consequently, it's not until that time that that's used.
What's your time frame again, 500?
Generally 500 to 1400 at the max.
And where is the Inquisition in this?
The Inquisition comes in the 1200s. See, right after after the Fourth Crusade, which destroys essentially Byzantine Empire to a certain extent, certainly destroys Constantinople for a time, and then they instead of going to the Holy Land, they're going to the Albigensians in Provence for a variety of reasons. And Saint Dominic is sent there in order to convince the Albigensians not to have this particular heresy. This is a long story, and I'll tell you more about it if you want to know. But it is that time then they start the Inquisition, where they ask people if they can, if they are going to believe. And the film on Thursday night, if you're here, has a little element of that Inquisition.
What's the name of it?
It's The Sorceress. So it shows a little bit of what was going on in that Inquisition.
Have you read the book, The Irish Sage?
Yes,
Is that what you were alluding to, except you said it was the Brits?
Actually, no, I didn't really allude to that. What was going on there is, I did allude a little bit, that St. Patrick had learned Christianity from the Romans, essentially, carried it to the Irish, and come back to learn more. Then the Irish, then, as you know if you've read the book, have you read it?
I've got the book, but I haven't read it yet.
Yeah, Evelyn's read it. Then the Irish, say Columba and so say Columbana, come back down to, like, Foley into Germany and establish monasteries there. So you have this Christianity brought down from the north into the main part of Europe, and so you have there a monastic a revival that, and this is early on, this is in the 700s. So it's before there's this, the church has really strength. Then the monastic movement really starts with great strength in the 900s.
It's called the Dark Ages. What period of time is it?
Well, you'd probably say the darkest ages were 500 to 800, when we have very little literature. But they're discovering more all the time. Little snatches, they're finding new ways of putting the evidence together in order to get information. And actually, the time of the people, the way the people lived in 800, the time of Charlemagne, the people I'm talking about, are not, that does not change much until the 1100s, where it gets to, then there's a difference because of the improvement in economics and so forth.
What was the reason for the lack of literature in that time?
What do you write on? Who can write? They say, by the way, that they figure 100 million sheep were killed for their skins during the Middle Ages.
Sheep.
Just to get the parchment to write on. And if you've ever looked at those books, they're very small. And they have to be, the size of the books are determined by the size of the sheepskin.
In the meantime, the Egyptians
had paper.
Papyrus, yeah, did it not come?
It came in gradually, but during the early time, especially during the Dark Ages, they don't have it. And they're just not a lot of people, we do not have the writings, the stories, the journals that people wrote later.
But another thing, the books were almost a privilege to have because they were so expensive.
Yeah, though they were so rare. Mm-hmm. And they had to be copied gradually. There are many, now we go back, we have a momentous number of books that were written and illustrated during the Middle Ages. Now, but you see in 500, 600, mm-hmm. there are not very many. So you're just beginning, and they're starting by copying what they've got. They're not writing new things, they're copying. At least that's the way it seems to us from what we've known. But there are a lot, there are a lot of books still extant, believe it or not. I find this period very fascinating. And there's so much to say. I think tomorrow afternoon I'm going to be talking about what faith, what did people really believe at this time? What was it that was going on in the minds? How did people live and deal with it? And then Thursday we're going to be seeing this film on the sorcerers, which is dealing with the Inquisition, but it also deals with a lot of other things, the way the people were living, the relationship between the people and the feudal lords, the relationship, what a priest was really doing, what kind of life a priest actually lived, and how he supported his people and so forth. I think it has a variety of interesting. Then on Saturday, let's see, what is it? Maybe it's the Normans. I'm not sure what I've actually said I'll do on Saturday. But it's, it's pilgrimages. Pilgrimages on Saturday. And,
interesting, very interesting. You know, I just here read the book on life on Teresa of Avila.
Oh, yes.
And that gives you also a really good idea what the
monastic.
Yeah. Life was like that.
Uh-huh. That's later.
Yeah, 1500, yes. 16th century.
Yes, right. Yes. And Bernina has that statue of her in Rome with this great light coming on her. Yeah, and Bernina. So it's
I have a question. I don't even know for sure how to put it, but What incident was it at the Gottesberg on the Rhine, where the castle, it seemed to me one of the local lords or somebody who wanted to be king was contesting the right of the Pope, and as a consequence the castle was destroyed. Does that ring a bell?
That does not ring a bell to me.
Can you help me?
It's not unusual that anybody who is going to contest something. I don't think the Pope would have had the power to do that afterwards, and he wasn't. I don't think that happened during the Middle Ages. So it may have happened in some other way afterwards. You might check that out and let me know about it.
I think
he had the little book on the
Yeah. It's very interesting because it took them 2 years to dig a tunnel under the castle because they couldn't capture the castle, and then they blew it up. They blew up one wall. That's all you have to do if you have a breakthrough. Yes.
Actually, those castles, you see, were not built. Those stone castles were not built until later. We often get the impression that they were built very early on, but they weren't. Initially, they would have some fortification around it, but you don't really start building stone walls around the castles until the Vikings come in. And then they start building them around the monasteries because the Vikings are attacking the monasteries because that's where the riches are. And then they start building, it's actually the monasteries become the nucleus for a lot of the towns.
Yes.
The burghers are those who build up against the walls of the monasteries because that's a safe place. So a suburb. Is from the burghers that were around the outside of the walls. So, and then the castles only begin to have this great development. We learn more how to build castles from the Muslims. So after the Crusades, we learn more about building castles. So we come back after that and build some of these tremendous castles. And then you have to do this on mining in order to get in a variety of ways of getting into it.